Hello everyone, and welcome to the Russian Empire History Podcast, the history of all the peoples of the Russian Empire. I'm your host, JP Bristow. This is Season 1, The Forest, the Steppe, and the Birth of the Russian Empire. Episode 7, Herodotus and the Scythians. The Scythians say that their nation is the youngest in all the world, and it came into being in this way. This country was once a desert, and a man named Targeteus appeared. His parents, they say, I do not believe it myself, was Zeus and a daughter of the river Borysthenes. That, they say, was Targeteus' lineage. And he had three sons, Lipoxeus, Arpoxeus, and the youngest, Colaxeus. At the time of their rule, so the story goes, a golden plough, a yoke, a sword, and a flask fell from the sky into Scythia. The eldest brother tried to take them, but when he drew close, they began to burn and drove him back. Then the second brother tried, but the burning gold drove him back too. Last came the youngest brother, and the burning died away at his approach. So he took the gold into his house. His brothers understood how things were, and gave all royal power to the youngest. Lipoxeus was the father of the Scythian clan called the Alcetae, Arpoxeus of the Catiari and Traspes, and the youngest, who was king, of the Paralatae. They are all called the Scolotti. Scythians is a name given to them by the Greeks. But the story told by the Greeks is as follows. Heracles, driving the cattle of Geryones, came into this land, which was then desert, but is now inhabited by the Scythians. Geryones dwelt westward of the Pontus, on the island the Greeks called Erythea, on the shore of the ocean near Gadira, outside the Pillars of Heracles. Heracles came thence to the country now called Scythia, where, meeting with wintry and frosty weather, he drew his lion's skin around him and fell asleep. While he slept, his mares, which were grazing yoked at a chariot, were spirited away. When Heracles awoke, he searched for them, visiting every part of the country, until he finally came to a land called the Woodland. There in a cave, he found a creature that was woman from the waist up, and serpent below. He was astonished to see her, and asked if she had seen his mares wandering anywhere. She said that she had taken them, and would not return them until Heracles slept with her, which he did, hoping to get his horses back. But although he wanted to get the horses and leave, she was in no hurry, and tried to keep Heracles with her. At last she gave them back, saying, "These mares came, and I kept them safe for you, and you have paid me for keeping them, with these three sons. Tell me now, what should I do when they grow up? Shall I make them stay here in my country where I am queen, or send them to you?" Heracles answered, "When you see the boys become men, whichever of them you see bending this bow and donning this belt, let him dwell in this land, but whoever fails in these tasks, send him away." So he drew one of his bows, until then Heracles had always carried two, showed her the belt with the golden clasp. When the sons were grown, she named them Agathyrsus, Galons, and the youngest Scythus. Remembering her charge, she did as Heracles had commanded. Agathyrsus and Galonus were unable to achieve the task, and were cast out. But the youngest, Scythus, accomplished it, and so remained in the land. From Scythus, son of Heracles, comes the line of the kings of Scythia. This is the tale told by the Greek dwellers in Pontus. There is yet another tale, which is the one I incline to myself. It goes as follows. The nomad Scythians inhabiting Asia, being hard-pressed in war by the Massagetae, fled across the river Araxes to the Cimmerian country. The country the Scythians now inhabit is said to have belonged to the Cimmerians. And the Cimmerians, at the advance of the Scythians, took counsel as men threatened by a great host should. Their opinions were divided. The commoners wished to withdraw, and saw no need to risk their lives for the dust of the earth, while the princes wished to defend their country against the invaders. Neither could persuade the other to agree, so one part planned to depart without fighting, while the princes were resolved to die in their own country. Being thus resolved, they parted into two equal bands and fought each other until all were slain. Then the commoners buried them in the tombs that can still be seen, and departed, and the Scythians came and took possession of the empty country. These three origin stories come from Book 4 of Herodotus' The Histories, and give a good idea of his approach and of why it has been criticized. Here he presents the Scythians' own myth about their origins, the one the Greeks in the Black Sea colonies supposedly told, and the story he claims to think is what actually happened. Although the first two have a few elements in common, there is obviously no need to take them as anything other than stories. However, many scholars have also rejected the third story, even though, as we know from last week's episode, Scythians did indeed come from the east. Herodotus' descriptions of Scythian life are fascinating, and given that the Scythians had disappeared for centuries before the Kurgans were excavated, mysterious, and attracted particular attention from Herodotean scholars. Whether they were approaching the histories with a view to proving them right or wrong, or approaching them as literature and cultural history, they have largely agreed that his tales of the Scythians are mostly, maybe completely, fictitious. German scholar Detlef Felling has argued that Herodotus is largely invented, including his supposed sources, and he particularly notes the account of the Scythians' origin myth as an example of this invention. According to Felling, the story is based on the Greek trope of genealogical literature with three brothers as successors, like Zeus, Poseidon, and Hades taking over from Uranus and Cronus. However, this position grows out of a Eurocentric approach to the classical era and disregards Central Asian historical and archaeological material, which actually supports much of what Herodotus writes. First, it is actually a step tradition for the youngest son to receive the biggest inheritance. One famous example is in the Secret History of the Mongols, where Chinggis Khan's ancestor, Bodonchar, is the youngest son of clan leader Alankoa. According to Herodotus, once Kolaxes had become king, he divided the kingdom into lordships for his sons, with the designated successor having the largest share. This is also common in steppe culture. The empires of Attila the Hun, Chinggis Khan, and Turkic states across the steppe acted in the same way. The allegedly Greek version of the origin story also has steppe elements. Heracles orders that all of the sons who fail his test be sent away, and it is well attested that sons outside the line of inheritance were sent away in the steppe. The gifts of the bow and belt are also significant. If you look at some Scythian art online, you will see that a belt with a gorytos, a combined quiver and bow case, hung at the left hip, was the characteristic equipment of the Scythian warrior. The belts were often elaborate, and decorated with embellishments and gold fittings. A steppe warrior's status was defined by proficiency with the bow, and the belt and garitas were symbols of that status. The names of the three brothers, Lipoxeus, Agroxeus, and Calaxeus, are Iranic. The ending derives from the Iranian word Xaya, which means king. It has been argued that Lipo, Apo, and Kola derive from the Iranian words for mountain, water, and sun, which correspond to the division of the world in Vedic and Zoroastrian traditions, and the division of people into priest, farmer, and warrior. These steppe elements in the origin myths suggest that they could indeed have come from Scythian sources. But Felling has no time for the third story either, on the basis that empires belong to the strong, and that the idea that Scythians were driven out of Asia by the Massagetae and then drove the Cimmerians out of the Pontic steppe just isn't common sense. There might be something to this argument if we did not have so many examples of other peoples driven out of one territory, successfully setting up in another territory throughout steppe history. The Xiongnu in Mongolia defeated the Weiji, who were displaced to Bactria. In Bactria, the Weiji drove out the Saka, who then defeated the Hellenistic Greco-Bactrian kingdom on their way to Iran, where their descendants still live. The Avars were driven out by the Turks, the Magyars by the Pecheneks, and the Cumans by the Mongols, all going on to be highly successful in their new lands. So Herodotus' story here actually seems pretty plausible. And as we discussed in the last episode, the archaeological evidence does now support the migration of the Scythians from the east. Herodotus includes the story of the Scythians driving out the Cimmerians, who moved into the Near East. And this story is supported in other sources. According to Herodotus, the Scythians pursued the Cimmerians into the Near East, where they attacked and destroyed a Median army besieging Ninus, and then carried on down to Palestine, where the Egyptian king Psammiticus bought them off. Assyrian chronicles record the Cimmerians arriving in Assyria in 679 BCE, when they were defeated by King Esarhaddon. The pursuing Scythians turned up not long after, and seem to have been a bit tougher to deal with. Although the chronicle claims the Assyrians defeated them too, it also reports that King Esarhaddon had to marry his daughter to the king of the Scythians, likely a man named Protothais, which makes that somewhat unlikely. The chronicle also records the Scythians being involved in the wars between the Assyrians and the Medes, usually, but not always, on the side of the Assyrians. So, as far as origins of the Scythians goes, we have to say that the archaeological records and other history support the general outline of the Herodotus story. Another line of attack on Herodotus' Scythians can be found in the work of Françoise Artaud, who focuses on depictions of foreigners, or the other, in histories. He argues that Herodotus' histories are merely a collection of myths intended to put the known world within the context of Greek knowledge, rather than to provide an accurate picture of the world outside of the Greek sphere. He goes so far as to dismiss what he calls external evidence, that's archaeological, historical, anthropological evidence and so on, as unhelpful, and says that Herodotus' Scythians should be taken merely as a symbol of what the Greeks are not, a quote, imaginary representation of the other. Artaud insists that Herodotus' description of the Scythians as a nomad power cannot be historically true. For Herodotus, all barbarians have kings and centralized government, and so he gives the Scythians kings and government so that he can fit them into his narrative category of barbarians. Actually, says Artog, quote, the existence of power is a denial of nomadism. This seems like a quite remarkably Eurocentric view. Do we remember the names of Attila and Chinggis Khan, the remove of centuries because they had no power, organization, or central rule? Nomadism does not in any way preclude the development and centralization of authority. We actually know that steppe nomads were quite administratively sophisticated. Herodotus describes how the Scythians are organized, with provinces called nomes, led by nomarchs under the king. Nomes and nomarchs are the terms that were used by the Egyptians for their administrative structure, and Artok puts this down to Herodotus, again representing the Scythians, in terms that Greeks would understand, without any real basis for doing so. However, a couple of centuries later, Chinese sources from the other end of the steppe describe the same administrative structure among their neighboring nomads. An emperor, aided by an imperial government, presiding over regional provincial leaders, who in turn governed local tribal leaders in territories of various sizes. In wartime, a unified army, organized on a decimal basis, that's tens, hundreds, thousands of people, would be drawn from across the steppe. Similar structures were used by other steppe cultures over the centuries. So it is entirely possible, maybe even probable, that the Scythians were organized as Herodotus described. Think back to their origin story at the beginning of this episode, which divided the nation into three. An organizational division that was also found in other steppe peoples, like the Xiongnu. So, if we accept that Herodotus, king of the Scythians, was real, and not him attempting to shoehorn steppe nomads into Greek barbarian stereotypes, what did he say about the king? Herodotus describes the king as the head of the royal Scythians, the high-prestige elite warrior tribe of Scythians, who were overlords of all the Scythian groups. The king led the army in wartime and was the source of justice in peacetime, including presiding over duels. The king was semi-divine, recall those origin stories again, and the Scythians believed that the king could become sick due to actions by his subjects, such as perjury. Perjury, therefore, became a kind of regicide and highly taboo. The shamans, as the people responsible for curing diseases, would identify the perjurer responsible for making the king sick and punish him appropriately. Herodotus gives us a picture of the king as war leader in the tale of the Persian invasion of Scythia, which forms the core of Book 4 of the Histories. In his telling, Darius invades Scythia because, quote, Asia was bursting with men and earning vast revenues, and Darius wished to punish the Scythians for the wrong they had begun when they invaded Media and defeated those who opposed them in battle. For the Scythians, as I have said before, ruled Upper Asia for 28 years. They invaded Asia in the pursuit of the Cimmerians and ended the power of the Medes, who were the rulers of Asia before the Scythians came. Desiring to punish them for what they had done, Darius assembled an army against them. End quote. The Persian campaign against the Scythians has been held up as the classic example of Herodotus just making stuff up for decades, if not hundreds of years. His alleged lack of geographical knowledge is derided, and the most generous summer scholars allow themselves to be, is the claim that the whole tale is meant to illustrate the weaknesses of the mighty Persian Empire that allowed the apparently few and insignificant Greeks to beat them. But actually, a lot of what Herodotus says is quite plausible. For example, when Darius sends spies to scout the Scythians, they go by Penteconta, not trireme. Triremes were the main battleships of the day, but Pentecontas were smaller with a shallower draft and could have travelled along the rivers of southern Russia and Ukraine. When the Persians march into Scythia, they wear themselves out, fruitlessly chasing the Scythians, who never stand and fight. And when they give up, they are harried all the way back. And Herodotus shows that he understands why this is the result of going to war against a nomadic people. So, the story of the Persian invasion of Scythia is the backbone of Book 4, providing quite a long narrative with numerous digressions along the way, in which Herodotus introduces the Scythians, their tribes, origins, beliefs, practices, and other aspects of their lives. I'm going to read the main story of the invasion, mildly paraphrased and with those digressions cut out. And after looking at that, we will turn to a few of those little scenes from Scythian life. But the Scythian race has made the cleverest discovery we know in what is the most important of all human affairs. I do not praise the Scythians in all respects, but in this, the most important one. They have contrived that no one who attacks them can escape, and no one can catch them if they do not want to be found. For when men have no established cities or forts, but are all nomads and mounted archers, not living by tilling the soil, but by raising cattle and carrying their dwellings on wagons, how can they not be invincible and unapproachable? They have made this discovery in a land that suits their purpose and has rivers that are their allies. The country is flat and grassy and well watered. Convinced that they would not be able to repel Darius' army in open warfare alone, the Scythians sent messengers to their neighbors, whose kings were already deliberating on the great army approaching them. The assembled kings were those of the Tauri, Agathyrsi, Neurae, Maneaters, Blackcloaks, Geloni, Budini, and Sauromatae. The kings of the aforesaid nations having gathered, the Scythian messengers came and laid everything before them, that having conquered the whole other continent subject to him, Darius had crossed into their continent by a bridge across the Bosphorus, and having now crossed it and subjugated the Thracians, he now intended to make the whole region subject to him like the others. "Do not stand aside and let us be destroyed," they said. "Let us unite and oppose this invader. If you will not, then we shall either be driven out or forced to make terms. And afterward, it will not be easy for you, for the Persian has come to attack you no less than us, and when he has subjugated us, he will not be content to leave you alone. The kings of the Geloni and the Budini and the Sauromatae were of one mind and promised to help the Scythians. But the kings of the Agathyrsi, Neurae, Maneaters, Blackcloaks, and Tauri gave this answer to the messengers: If it wasn't you who wronged the Persians first and started the war, that is, referring to the Scythians attacking the Medes, what you ask would seem right, and we would listen. But you invaded their land without us and ruled the Persians, and the Persians are only repaying you in kind. If the Persian comes against our land and begins the wrongdoing, we will not accept it, but until then we will keep to ourselves." When this answer was brought back to the Scythians, they determined not to meet their enemy in the open field, but rather to fall back, driving off their herds, choking the wells, and destroying the grass from the earth. They divided themselves into two companies. One of their divisions, which Scopasus ruled, added the Sauromatae. If the Persians marched their way, this group would fall back towards the Tanais, and if the Persians turned to go back, they would pursue them and attack. The other division united those ruled by Idanthiasis and those ruled by Taxakis, joined with the Gelonae and the Budini, to draw off at the Persian approach, always keeping one day's mark ahead of the enemy and avoiding confrontation. They would retreat in a straight line across the countries which refused their alliance, so that they would become involved against their own will, and then they would turn back and attack the enemy. The Scythians sent the wagons in which their children and wives lived north, and sent all their flocks with them, keeping back only what was required for food. The advance guard of the Scythians found the Persians 3 days' march from the Ister, and set about scorching the earth. When the Persians saw the Scythian cavalry, they marched on its track, the horsemen always withdrawing before them, with the Persians in pursuit towards the east and the Tanais River. The horsemen crossed, and the Persians crossed also, pursuing them through the land of the Sauromatae to the land of the Budini. In Scythian and Sauromatic territory, the Persians had nothing to harm, as the land was dry and barren. But when they entered the country of the Budini, they found a wooden-walled town that had been abandoned, and burned it. When Darius came into the desolate country, he halted in his pursuit and camped, building 8 great forts. While he was occupied with building these, the Scythians doubled back into Scythia. Darius abandoned the forts and marched west, thinking that the Scythian army was fleeing. When he came by forced marches into Scythia, he met the 2 divisions of the Scythians and pursued them. But they always stayed a day ahead of him. As this went on a long time and did not stop, Darius sent a horseman to Idanthiasis, the Scythian king, with this message: "You crazy man, why do you always run when you can do otherwise? If you believe yourself strong enough to withstand my power, stand and fight. If you know you are weaker, stop running and come to terms with your master, bringing gifts of earth and water." Idanthiasis, the Scythian king, replied, "It is like this with me, Persian. I never ran from any man before out of fear, and I am not running from you now. I am not doing any differently from what I do in time of peace. We Scythians have no towns or cultivated land, out of fear of loss of which we would engage you sooner in battle. If all you want is to come to that quickly, we have the graves of our fathers. Come on, find these and try to destroy them. Then you will find out whether we will fight you or not. Until then, unless we have reason, we will not engage with you. As to fighting, enough. As to masters, I acknowledge Zeus my forefather, and Hestia queen of the Scythians only. As for gifts of earth and water, we shall send you such as ought to come to you, and for your boast that you are my master, I say weep." So the herald took this message to Darius, but the Scythian kings were filled with anger at the word slavery. They decided that they would no longer decoy the Persians, but would attack them when they were foraging for provisions. So they watched for Darius' men foraging, and did as they had planned. the Scythian horse always routed the Persian horse. And when the Persian cavalry would flee back to the infantry coming to their aid, the Scythians would turn back in fear of the infantry. And so the Persians gained little in the war, and the Scythians formed a plan to keep them in Scythia without necessities. They left some of the flocks behind, and the Persians would come and take the sheep and be encouraged by this achievement. After this had happened several times, Darius was at a loss, and when they saw this, the Scythian kings sent a herald with the gift of a bird, a mouse, a frog, and 5 arrows. The Persians asked what the gifts meant, but the herald said that he had only been told to deliver the gifts. It was for the Persians to figure out what they meant if they were smart enough. The Persians discussed it. Darius thought that the Scythians were surrendering themselves, their earth, and their water to him, reasoning that a mouse is a creature that lives on land and eats like a man. A frog is a creature of water. A bird is something like a horse, and arrows signified the Scythians surrendering their power. But one Gobryas disagreed. He said the meaning of the gifts was that unless you become birds and fly up into the sky, or mice and hide in the earth, or frogs and leap into the lakes, you will be shot by these arrows and never return home. After sending the gifts to Darius, the Scythians came out with foot and horse and offered battle to the Persians. But when the Scythian ranks were set in order, a rabbit ran out between the armies, and every Scythian that saw it gave chase. So there was confusion and shouting among the Scythians. Darius asked what all the noise was, and when he heard that they were chasing a rabbit, he said, "These men hold us in deep contempt, and I think now that Gobryas' opinion of the gifts was true. As I agree with him, we should consider how we can return safely." Gobryas advised Darius to wait until nightfall, build their campfires in the usual way, deceive those in their army least fit to endure hardship, and depart before the Scythians could cut off their retreat. Darius left the men who were worn out, and whose loss mattered least to him, in the camp with the asses. He left the asses because they would bray, and he pretended that the men he left were to guard the camp. When the asses found themselves deserted, they brayed even louder, and the Scythians heard them and assumed that the Persians were in the place. When day broke, the men left behind understood that they had been betrayed and surrendered to the Scythians. The Scythians quickly gathered their 2 divisions and set out in pursuit of the Persians. As the Persian army was mostly infantry and unfamiliar with the roads, while the Scythians were mounted and knew the shortcuts, they went wide of each other, and the Scythians reached the bridge long before the Persians. This was a bridge that Darius had had the Ionians build so that he could cross the Bosphorus into Scythia. The Scythians told the Ionians that they had been there too long, but if they would break the bridge and leave, they could go free, thanking the gods and the Scythians. The Ionians held council, trying to decide whether they were more scared of the Persians or the Scythians. In the end, they decided that they would act as if they were breaking the bridge up from the Scythian side, so that the Scythians would think that they were getting what they wanted. Then the Greek leader, Astyages, went to the Scythians and said, "See, we are breaking the bridge, and we'll be diligent about it, as we want to be free. But while we are breaking the bridge, this is your opportunity to go and find the Persians and punish them as they deserve." The Scythians took the Ionians' word for it and turned back to look for the Persians. But they missed the way their enemies had taken. The Scythians were to blame for this, because they had destroyed the horses' pasturage and blocked the wells. If they had not, they would have found the Persians at the wells. But the Scythians went looking in the parts of the country where they knew there was forage. The Persians, on the other hand, followed their tracks straight back to the bridge, in great alarm lest the Ionians had abandoned them. An Egyptian with Darius was the loudest man in the world. Darius had him stand on the bank of the Ister and call Histiaeus. The Egyptian shouted. Histiaeus heard him and sent the ships to ferry the army back and repair the bridge. And so the Persians escaped. The Scythians looked for them, but missed them again. Their judgment of the Ionians is that if they are free men, they are the basest and most craven in the world. But if they are slaves, none love their masters more. Thus have the Scythians taunted the Ionians. So, that is the story of how Darius invaded Scythia and failed to conquer it. This story has been criticized for many reasons. Some have dismissed it as completely made up by Herodotus. How could a bunch of nomad barbarians defeat the greatest empire in the world? Others have argued that it was just foreshadowing for the war between the Persians and the Greeks, setting up the idea that it was possible for the mighty empire to be defeated by a smaller foe. Still others have suggested that the Persians actually only conquered Thrace and merely made a foray across the Danube to intimidate the Scythians and discourage raiding. But besides not being at all like the narrative of the Greek war with the Persians, Herodotus' story is actually quite plausible, and he correctly identifies the factors that made the steppe nomads different and the tactics that made them successful warriors. First, that they are mobile. They don't have towns, cities, or farmlands to destroy. They can just send anyone too weak, old, or young away out of reach, take their herds, and leave. There is nowhere that the Persians can force them to take a stand and fight. When they do decide to fight, the Scythian cavalry always defeats the Persians. This is entirely plausible too. Scythian horses were bigger, stronger, and faster. We have evidence that steppe breeders consistently exported inferior horses to China and the Middle East. The Scythians lived in the saddle and were better horsemen. From all the descriptions we have of steppe warriors, we know that they were highly disciplined, capable of rapidly changing directions and formations, and they defeated almost everyone they fought for century after century. The strategic retreats and harrying tactics formed the basis of highly successful steppe warfare for almost 2,000 years, with other instances of sedentary enemies being lured into the steppe and gradually picked off, occurring throughout history. The ultimatum sent to Darius with the mouse, bird, frog, and arrows sounds fanciful, but actually fits with other instances from steppe history. Toktai, Khan of the Golden Horde, sent his rival Nogai a hoe, an arrow, and some earth. Nogai interpreted the message to mean, "If you hide in the earth, I will dig you out. If you rise to the sky, I will shoot you down," and took it to be a declaration of war. There are numerous other examples over the centuries of steppe leaders sending their enemies cryptic threats in this way. So, from the main story of the war, let's turn to some of the aspects of Scythian life that Herodotus describes. Naturally, given that the Kurgans were the most noticeable thing the Scythians built. Herodotus talks about their funeral practices, about how, when a king died, they removed the organs from the body, filled it with fragrant herbs, and transported it around the tribes. The tribal warriors would receive the body and express their mourning by disfiguring themselves, cutting their faces and arms, or putting an arrow through their hand. Once the body had been carried around, a pit would be dug and the body placed on a couch in the tomb with spears and enough space for a concubine, servants, a groom, horses, food, and golden cups. Then they would compete to raise the greatest possible barrow over the grave. A year after the burial of the king, they strangle 50 servants and 50 horses, removing their organs and stuffing them with chaff. The horses are placed on wheels set in the ground, supporting the fore and hindquarters so the legs are free, and the strangled men are mounted on the horses using stakes. Once the horsemen have been set out around the Kurgan like this, they leave. I'm sure you can recognize from our last episode that this matches archaeological finds in the Kurgans pretty exactly. The room with king, servants, and grave goods, and the sacrificed horses are all borne out in finds. The description of Scythians mutilating themselves in mourning is also very likely true. Similar practices are well attested in other steppe cultures over the centuries. Herodotus also says that the bodies were carried around or displayed for mourning for 40 days before burial, with the belief being that the soul only departed after 40 days. Removing the internal organs and packing the body with fragrant dried herbs would have helped to preserve the body through this period. This belief was obviously extremely important to the Scythians, important enough to be adopted by their successors and the settled peoples of the forest zone, forerunners of the Slavs, who were under their influence. It survived the arrival of Christianity and has become official Orthodox doctrine. To this day, Russians believe that the souls of the departed move on to their final destination only after 40 days, and that is when they hold the wake. Herodotus also describes the Scythians exchanging oaths with the mixing of blood. Warriors would cut themselves and gather the blood in a cup. The warriors would touch their weapons to the cup, swear their oaths to each other, and then drink the blood. Gold plaques depicting this practice have been found in Scythian graves. We have already mentioned the important place of dairy products in the development of steppe cultures, and Herodotus finds time for this too. He describes the Scythians milking horses, with the Scythians inserting a pipe into the mare's vulva and blowing to inflate and put pressure on the udder to make the milk flow. The slaves would then agitate the milk in barrels and skim off the top part, which is supposed to be the best. I think we can agree that this story is not true. The anatomical details don't seem like they would work. Horses are usually milked by using the foal to start the milk flow and then taking over with the milking, and that is most likely what the Scythians did too. But we can make the assumption that he was inaccurately reporting actual practices. As horse milk continues to be drunk on the steppe, we have more accurate descriptions available. The milk would indeed have been agitated, first to separate the fat for use, and then stirred regularly as it fermented into kumis over around 24 hours. Lastly, as this episode has become rather long, Herodotus discusses the ploughing or farming Scythians. Although the Scythians did not farm for their own food, which would have been shameful and reduced them to the level of soft city dwellers, it was entirely honourable for them to grow grain for trade, which they did through the Greek colonies of the Black Sea we discussed a couple of episodes ago. As we shall see in a later episode, the positive attitude to trade in the steppe, which was in contrast to settled cultures that considered land and farming the ultimate basis of wealth and respectability, would be very significant. The farming Scythians were closer to the forest steppe and forest ranges, where the nomad lifestyle shifted towards sedentary living. They blended with other peoples in the area, including Greeks, and built their own fortified settlements in this transitional zone. Herodotus describes the Budini tribe having one such city called Gelinus, with high wooden walls 6 kilometers long on each side, and wooden houses and temples. Like the other parts of his story, this has been dismissed by his critics as mere fable. Imagine the idea that steppe nomads could build a huge city. However, in 1906, a fortified settlement was discovered at Bielsk in Poltava region, Ukraine, right on the boundary between the steppe and the forest steppe. The settlement was extensively excavated in the 1960s to 1970s to uncover 3 settlements within a common earthen wall and moat extending over 35 kilometers. Together with its necropolis, the site covers around 80 square kilometers, with 40 square kilometers inside the walls. The remains show that the residents were mainly herders who also did some farming, and it is believed that this could have been Gelinus. That is not everything that Herodotus have to say about the Scythians and their neighboring tribes. I have left some points for future episodes as their subjects come up. But I think this is enough for you to see that despite the criticisms that have been made of his work, and especially his writings on the Scythians, there are plenty of reasons for us to take it seriously. Many of the critics from within classics ignore the history of steppe cultures, and as we saw in our episodes on the Kurgans, quite a bit of archaeology on the subject is only very recent. Although Herodotus did, as we saw in the opening extracts, enjoy and include stories and myths to make his work more entertaining for his admittedly Greek audience, that does not by any means make it made up or based simply on Greek ideas of how barbarians were supposed to live and behave. If you would like to read Herodotus on the Scythians for yourself, you will find it in Book 4 of the Histories, which is available online for free, as well as in numerous editions with notes and commentary, if you really want to get into it. The mounted archer cavalry that would be the classic steppe warriors for centuries until their final days in the successor states of the Mongol Empire emerged into maturity with the Scythians. In the next episode, we will take a close look at steppe warriors, the evolution of their weapons, armor, horses, tactics, and lifestyle. I hope you will join me then. Check out the socials for maps and pictures to go with the episodes and the Russian Empire History Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Please follow or subscribe to the podcatcher of your choice and share with your friends. If you would like to help support this podcast, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, or Good Pods. And thank you very much to those of you who already have. I enjoyed reading your reviews. You can reach me through Facebook or at hello@therussianempirehistorypodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you will join me next time.